The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Sunday early afternoon Space Show program. And I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. We're doing a full-length Space Show program today. But as always, watch the clock if you do want to provide an email or a call-in question for our guest, who I'll introduce in just a minute. Make sure you do it while we're still on the air. No last-minute kinds of things getting in and hoping we'll still be around. But we are on a full 90-minute program schedule today. Full week for next week, other than the fact that Hotel Mars will not be available since Mr. Batchelor is on one of his fact-finding traveling missions again. But we do have a Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday program. It's already up on the website newsletter, and all of that will be posted again in a little while after today's show ends. And we have open lines a week from today. So I know many of you like open lines, so mark it down for a week from today. I think that is September 29th. Now I have one sad note. A Space Show friend, an early Space Show guest who has been on the show many, many times, and a gentleman who I really like, Dr. David Criswell from the University of Houston, passed away a few days ago. I tried to get David back on the show about 6 weeks to maybe 2 months ago, and I didn't get a response from him, so I'm assuming now that I know he passed away on September 10th that he was ill. He was University of Houston physics professor emeritus. He was known mostly in the space world for space solar power and lunar-based solar power. He was a pioneer in space solar power from facilities on the moon. And he has some great historical space show programs about that, going back to the early years of the space show. So Criswell is spelled C as in Charlie, R-I-S-W-E-L-L, Dr. David Criswell, known as Dave. And we will miss him, and I am very sorry to learn of his passing. Leonard David told me about it this morning. And I consider him one of the early greats who helped make the space show what it is today. And all of the programs for this week will be in Dr. Criswell's memory. And when you get a chance, go back and look his name up on the search box and listen to some of his early shows. And he's right on the money. And, of course, we haven't advanced in that direction yet. So rest well, David, and the space show thanks you for all of your past support and your great insights into space. Excuse me, that brings us to today. So the toll-free number for today is 1-866-687-7223. And remember, no call screeners. Just let it ring. Be patient. We'll get you up on the air as quickly as possible. The email address is valid, drspace@thespaceshow.com. You can also post comments on our blog, which is on our website. So go all the way over to the far right to upcoming show menus, and the first show listed is our program today with Wayne White. And click on that page. And then down at the bottom, you'll see a place for comments and questions. And as soon as you post a comment or question on the blog, I'll get a copy of it, and I can bring it up on air with Wayne. And remember, you do not, let me repeat, do not have to be logged into your account on Discuss. That is our blog commentary program. You can do so very easily as a guest or a visitor, which, by the way, is how I post on the blog most of the time. I'm lazy and don't like to keep logging in. And besides, I don't remember the password. It's unbelievably long and convoluted. We welcome your blog comments as well. But keeping in mind it is a radio talk show, the toll-free line is the preferred number. So once again, 1-866-687-7223. And then the second preferred way, which is easier, is email drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Our full newsletter will be posted later this week, later today, not this week. Everything we do is archived. You can quickly listen online off of our website, where you can download the program. Don't forget, we do have a store if you're interested in space show paraphernalia. Find the pictures of Pepper listening to the space show on the far right on any of our website pages, and click on it, and Pepper will take you to the Cafe Press Space Show store. So in the upper left, there is a Listen Live button. So this tells you how to listen to the different formats of the space show, including a live broadcast like right now, online archives off of our website, which are compressed MP3 programs, and then our podcast, including on various podcast servers. So we're on the Apple format programs. I am an Apple user, so I know those the best. We're also in iTunes. We're in TuneIn, and we're in iHeartRadio. You can search for that. And then, obviously, we're in Droid formats for podcasts, although I don't know which ones they are, because those of you using Droid platforms and getting our podcast, don't tell me. I know you're listening to us on Droid platforms on podcasts. So if you share with me what apps you use for that, I'd be happy to announce those on the Space Show. If you have any questions with any of our podcasting, do let us know. And also remember, we're on Alexa, and TuneIn plays Alexa. There's probably other formats that play it too, but we are in TuneIn if you're an Alexa user. Some of these services are embedded on our website. If you go to the upper left, you'll see Listen Now or Listen Live, and you will find those different sites. To me, the most important part of all of this is that I have to fundraise. The Space Show is a nonprofit 501c3 with One Giant Leap Foundation.org. And the only way we bring you our programming is because many of you do financially contribute and support the Space Show. And as a nonprofit, if you're a federal U.S. taxpayer, you get a deduction for your gift. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer. Our nonprofit parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And if you go there, you can find out a lot more about our nonprofit. You can find out about being an advisory team member if you're interested. And lots more. And, of course, you can always email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. There is a PayPal link on our homepage, center right, and that tells you how to contribute electronically through PayPal. And in addition, that PayPal link has information on sending a check to One Giant Leap Foundation, Incorporated, in case you don't want to do so electronically. Then Amazon has a big link in the center because they have great programs for nonprofits. If you buy things on Amazon and you go through one of the two Amazon nonprofit portals with Amazon, they donate a percentage of your purchase price to the Space Show. So it's a great way to buy whatever you buy from Amazon and also help support the Space Show. And we do certainly appreciate that. And then finally, in terms of support, we offer sponsorships. So the sponsorships are on a calendar year basis. They get a banner ad that rotates across our homepage. You can change that banner ad whenever you want. And on full-length shows like today, I read a sponsor message at the first segment and then again when we come back from break. So for the first segment today, Northrop Grumman is a sponsor, and they are a leading global security company providing innovative systems, products, and solutions for government and commercial customers globally. And they offer extraordinary capabilities and technologies that go from undersea to outer space and cyberspace. The Space Foundation sponsors us. They're coming up on their 36th Space Symposium. They're always in Colorado Springs in early April. It is a place where you can connect, engage, and get business done all in one place. their exhibit hall alone, well, as you hear me say, I would defy anybody to complete it in one day. This is an amazing event. For more information for the 36th symposium this coming April, visit spacesymposium.org. And then, in addition, the AIAA sponsors it. This is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It's the largest aerospace professional society, and they have most of their members working in the field for different companies. So they are actually creating the engineering and the space projects and programs that exist and will exist in the future. You can meet them at their events because they have great attendance. And there is a library going back decades of peer-reviewed papers that you can access. The networking is amazing. So for more information, visit AIAA.org. You do not have to be an engineer to be a member. I am not an engineering member. I'm a non-engineering member. So check it out. And then finally, for the first segment, Moonwords is a great sponsor. What if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon and they based their decisions only on technical and economic merit? Moonwords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit moonwords.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. And that brings me to today's program. So I am very happy to bring back to the space show Wayne White, talk about early space show guests and supporters that have made the space show what it is today. Wayne White is one of those guys. I met him at a National Space Society event early on. We clicked. We're at another event with an organization in Washington, D.C., and Wayne is a terrific asset to the space show and the community. He is a space attorney with he's a senior space attorney at Whitcomb and Selinsky. This is in Denver. He is also founder and CEO of Space Booster LLC, which is a startup aerospace tech company. He graduated from Chapman University Law School in Orange, California, has his master's degree in business administration from UC Riverside, and actually his law degree is from Davis. He graduated undergraduate at Chapman. He is the author of many published space law articles and a frequent speaker in the field of national and international space law. And the last time he was on the show was May 5th of 2017. And then just before that, he was on May 3rd of 2013. And Wayne has created and is moving forward with the Space Pioneer Act. And it has gone through several iterations, and it's got some exciting participation in it, potentially. It has evolved since 2013 and 2017. Wayne, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you? It's good to talk to you again.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me on the show.
Did you know Dr. Criswell? You spent a lot of time in Texas. Did you ever come across him at the University of Houston?
I believe I met him at some point, but we weren't close. I didn't really know him more than being an acquaintance.
And I knew he came to NSS events early on, too, because they've always been interested, as you know, in space solar power. So anyway, I just thought I would ask if you were acquainted with him. What's happening with Space Pioneer Act? Are we about to see it?
Yes. In fact, I'm planning on taking a leave of absence in October to finish it. I've largely completed the property rights section, and the mining law section I gave a presentation at the Space Resources Roundtable this past June, and so I'm ready to write that section. And then the salvage law section of the Act will be a lot easier to write, and it won't be nearly as long. The part that I have finished, the property rights section, is by far the longest section of the Act. So I believe I will be able to have this done and into congressmen and senators' offices by the end of October.
So when you say the Property Rights Act, is this a treaty, an ML, a multilateral treaty? Is that a policy that the U.S. is to accept? Is what form is it? Is it, does it have to go through Congress and be debated and then renegotiated and all that crap?
Yes, but that process is a lot faster than negotiating a new UN treaty. And so one of the basic thrusts of my work from the very beginning has been the path of least political resistance, mainly internationally, but also here in the United States. And that's a good lead-in to my basic approach to this. Because it takes so long for treaties to get negotiated, the Moon Treaty is an example. It took a long time to negotiate, and then not very many countries have signed and ratified it. So the Outer Space Treaty prohibits territorial sovereignty, but it also provides that the nation that registers the space object shall have jurisdiction over that space object and the personnel that are in outer space that are U.S. citizens in the case of the United States. So when I first wrote Real Property Rights in Outer Space, I said, well, is there a way that each nation could pass a law and then have the net effect be the same as if perhaps there were a treaty? Actually, if each nation passes their own laws, these laws can be much more detailed than you would expect in a treaty. One of the problems with the Moon Treaty was that it had a common heritage of mankind provision that the parties that ratified that treaty or the parties that negotiated that treaty didn't really agree on what that meant. And that's one of the issues that I have, I think a lot of people have with the space treaties, is that they don't have any definitions, because if you define the terms, then it becomes very, very difficult for the parties to agree on the language of the treaty. So, if each nation enacts their own property law, the example that led me to this approach was the Deep Sea Hard Mineral Resources Act. It's a United States Act where the United States government became frustrated with the processes of negotiating treaties and what had happened with the Moon Treaty. And so the United States and four or five other nations enacted laws, national laws, for mining the seabed for manganese nodules and other valuable minerals that are down on the floor of the ocean. And each one of those nations' laws, including the United States, had a reciprocity provision, and it said, we will recognize the claims of any other nation that has a law substantially similar to our law. And so I'm following the same approach with the Space Pioneer Act. It's a national law that would go through congressional review and hopefully be enacted and signed into law by the president. One of the things that makes it easier to get this law passed is that it has very little fiscal impact. There will be very little expense to taxpayers for passing this law, and it will provide a lot of incentive and a legal framework for the commercial activities that we're anticipating in outer space.
So, but that means our version of property rights would have to be pretty similar, say, to pick a country, France, if they enacted it, or the UAE, or Luxembourg, right? Well, probably it is similar to Luxembourg. But there might be countries where our version of property rights is not compatible with their version of property rights. So then what happens?
You know, that's a very good point. And in fact, maybe I need to add a section to say these are the general provisions that we would expect in order to recognize another nation's laws pursuant to the reciprocity provision. Those basic elements would include, and I haven't, you know, made an exhaustive list, but the primary one would be that the law should say that this law shall not in any way be the basis for any territorial claims. And that's prohibited by the Outer Space Treaty, Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty. And that will be woven throughout the text of this act. And so things like that that are part of the basic approach, you know, that each nation's laws would have to have at least those basic elements in order to be recognized by the United States, in order for claims under those foreign laws to be recognized by the United States.
Could you get a, under the United States law on, with property rights, I can get a marketable deed and I can borrow money on it or sell it. Is that going to be somehow possible with space property rights, even though there's no territorial rights?
Correct. Yes. It's sort of like, I don't know what the law is now in Mexico, but I heard, you know, many years ago that you couldn't buy property in Mexico, but you could get a 99-year lease. This is sort of like the 99-year lease. As long as there is a space object in the area of the claim to property right, the U.S. will have jurisdiction over that area, or will have a jurisdiction over the space object. A key element of the mining law and the property law is that there will have to be due diligence on the part of either of the private entity that's doing that. Private entity would include an individual family or an individual company. Families won't be allowed to take their kids up to space until we have, you know, until we're sure that it's safe, primarily from a radiation shielding standpoint. Nations will be able to make claims, and they can. The courts will be able to look at existing terrestrial mining law and property law for analogies, which will make it easier for the courts to render decisions. Even though the U.S. will have jurisdiction over an area, as long as the space object is there, my law, the Space Pioneer Act, will provide that they have to have due diligence, that they have to be actually operating the facility. And this is another one of the key points that is, I think is very important, is that we don't want people to just land a space object and then do nothing with it solely for the purpose of making a property claim and then just sit on the claim, you know, waiting for the property to be more valuable. That's the last thing that we want to happen. And so, even though the U.S. will have jurisdiction as long as that space object is there, under this law, the people that claim property rights will have to have had the facility operational for a period of 2 years before they can perfect their claim, and thereafter they'll have annual due diligence requirements that they either... We realize that space objects won't be occupied on a permanent basis for some time until we have the infrastructure and facilities available that provide long-term radiation shielding. So they can, you know, they'll be able to keep their property right by using the property intermittently, but they'll have to demonstrate that they have either spent money on a future mission to that property or that they've spent money operating the facility and or that they've spent money operating the facility. So this is only going to give property rights to people that put the property to beneficial use.
Ted is in San Diego with a question, and he says, I'm not sure I'm understanding you. A U.S. company wants to do something on the moon. So does the U.S. government then have jurisdiction for all of the moon? What if the U.K. wants to go to the moon, or the UAE, or Russia, or China? Do we have jurisdiction on the moon over anything they want to do?
Well, yes and no. The United States, pursuant to the Outer Space Treaty, has jurisdiction over space objects and its national personnel, which would be U.S. citizens and permanent residents of the United States. However, And so the U.S. will have jurisdiction over a safety zone. This is a new, it's not a new concept, but it's something new to U.S. law. And the jurisdiction for a safety zone is not tied to the territory per se. It's actually part of the non-interference principle, which is a general principle of international law, and it's also addressed in the Outer Space Treaty. So the U.S. has jurisdiction over space objects, and we will be asserting jurisdiction over a safety zone, but that safety zone will be tied to the space object, and if the space object is ever removed, then the U.S. will have no longer will have any jurisdiction.
What is the definition of a space object? Is the moon the space object?
No. The United, pursuant to the Registration Convention, which is a different UN treaty that the United States is party to, every nation that launches every nation whose citizens or residents launch an object into outer space, it will be listed on the U.S. Register of Space Objects and then reported to the UN Office of Outer Space Affairs, which will then in turn put it on the International Registry of Space Objects. So each claimant for a property claim, it will be related to a space object or areas of ongoing activities. So if there was an area that a company was doing mining activities in, it wouldn't be just tied to the equipment and whatever pressurized or unpressurized facility they might have there, but the non-interference provision or concept would also allow the U.S. to assert jurisdiction over national activity in that area. In other words, areas where U.S. citizens or permanent residents are walking around in spacesuits on the surface of the moon, it's necessary to protect that activity from interference, which might raise safety issues and other issues.
Okay. This sounds like, to the layman, it's pretty complicated. Is it?
Well, it won't be after we pass this law. That's one of the reasons for passing this law is, you know, how can we provide laws and regulations to govern our citizens' activities while still ensuring that we're compliant with the Outer Space Treaty and the promises that we've made to not interfere with other nations' activities and to provide free access to areas of outer space. There's a tension in the Outer Space Treaty. It provides nations with jurisdiction, but it also says that there shall be free access to all areas of outer space. And so the tension is there because other nations can't interfere with our activities. And so we will have a limited amount of jurisdiction over foreigners that come inside of our safety zone. They would have to come in with permission first. And our country would have jurisdiction over foreign citizens if they were within the area of our property.
Okay. And this would be similar for another country in the area of their claim or property.
Right. I would anticipate that other nations would enact the safety zone concept, which has been around for a long, long time, and back from the early space age, when both the United States and the Soviet Union said that we should have safety zones. Those aren't official statements. Those are statements of U.S. and USSR attorneys, space lawyers, who had written articles and said, we believe there needs to be safety zones, or in the case of the USSR, they call them keep-out zones. Establishing the safety zone concept will be very helpful also for the U.S. Department of Defense. If you know, there have been a lot of incidents where other nations have brought their space objects up close to the United States. This is primarily something that Russia has done. But by extending the safety zone concept to satellites, the U.S. can make it a policy that no one should enter the safety zone without the permission of the United States or the private facility operator. And anybody that does so without permission, that would be a violation of international law, because that's an area that's subject to U.S. jurisdiction. I would expect other nations to recognize that jurisdictional authority for safety reasons, among many others. If you look to the International Space Station, they have an area that they monitor that's 30 miles in all directions, and they monitor that area for to prevent collisions. And when a cargo vehicle goes up to the station, when it gets within a certain distance of the station, the station takes over and they attach the robotic arm to the space object and bring it in for docking in a very controlled manner, also to prevent collisions. There are really good reasons for a safety zone.
To make this personal, it's almost like people, individuals, have sort of a personal space zone around them. And if you get too close or you invade that personal space, that's like harassment or other problems that you've created, because
you're
intimidating
with someone from France. They like to be very close.
and smoking a cigarette in your face at the same time. But that's kind of something similar, is we each have our own personal space, and we always hear about you're invading my space, or I want to keep my personal space. That's kind of my safety zone or your safety zone, right?
Yes.
So same kind of thing. Except
good analogy.
Except I don't know if the UN protects my personal space. So. Can I file a UN action?
So
where,
I don't think so.
Where do we stand with this, Wayne, in terms of advancing from your promoting it and talking about it and sharing the information with us on the space show to something actually being in play procedurally, politically, policy-wise?
Well, I'm pretty optimistic, because by all indications there's going to be bipartisan support for this. It will definitely provide a strong stimulus for investment in space activities, and it will take our economy in one of the directions that I think everybody would like to see us take, which is developing new markets, developing new sources for resources, and moving industrialized processes that pollute out into free space to the extent that we can.
So you think it's going to become law?
Yes. I would be surprised if it didn't, actually.
Even in this era of lacking bipartisanship?
Even in this area, yeah, because there's going to be environmental provisions in here. There are things in here that both parties will like. And I don't think there's anything in here that anybody is going to be horribly against either.
Does the president like something like this, do you think?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Because they usually go back and forth and negotiate this. How do you think the final form of it would look?
Well, I hope it's not too much different than what I say. There are some issues that I'll be addressing that may have to be revised because there are ongoing activities. A prime example of that is protecting historical sites on the moon, which is something I've always been an advocate that, of course, we need to protect our historical sites. And so because the government is kind of looking at the historical, the process of recognizing historical sites in outer space, I'm going to write what I think is the best, but I realize that it may be subject to change depending on where they are with that process in Washington.
We have, for all moonkind, Michelle Hanlon coming back on the show in a week, and she's strongly out in front on as people know, protecting historical sites on the moon. So, and they seem to be getting a lot of traction even globally on that. So,
yes, yeah, and what I'm proposing is something that will tie into the global process for historical, a World Heritage Site.
Do you talk with them at all? Do you know that group?
I haven't, and I'm glad that you told me that she has done work in that area. I will have to listen to, you know, make it a point to put that show on my schedule.
She was at ISDC. I'm surprised you didn't meet her. She gave a presentation at ISDC for her organizations for allmoonkind.org, I guess, because it's a public benefit corporation.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if you ever want to meet her, let me know, and I will let you know. She's an active part of that Rand Sinberg group that I told you about as well.
Mm-hmm.
You have a
phone call.
Yeah, you have a phone call from a listener. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Marshall in little old Renfro, Oklahoma.
Okay, we always know your introduction, Marshall. That's very, very unique. Go ahead.
Basically, earlier you were talking about abandoned property, and here in Oklahoma, you know, abandoned property is something that comes up on a county level when somebody doesn't pay the property taxes. Basically, the property is put up for auction, and usually it sells, but sometimes it just sits for 4 or 5 years. And believe me, where I am, there's several pieces of property that, you know, could be bought up for like $50. Why isn't that kind of system put in there for, you know, space mining and so on like that? Property is basically taxed for, you know, taking up space in space.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think it's appropriate for us at this point to be taxing property in outer space. I think it's too soon. That's a disincentive for actually expanding into outer space. But the way this works, if a company that has a facility on the moon abandons it, it's unlikely that would happen because of the way this law will be written, or actually the property rights section is already written. Because the property right has some residual value, you know, perhaps the company goes bankrupt and, or they just decide that that facility isn't making money, it would be crazy for them to just let this property sit abandoned and not file their due diligence. Then they would just lose their property right. The way out of this, if they're in a situation where they don't want to operate it anymore or they can't operate it anymore, the way out of that is to sell the property to another individual that would take over and operate, you know, another entity that is willing to operate the facility, or to remove the facility and put something else there while still maintaining the right to be at that location. So there will be a way to make that happen. And there will be an incentive for people to do that, but there won't be any tax liens or anything like that. No property sales of abandoned property. If a company becomes insolvent, the route to go will be bankruptcy, because the law will provide that bankruptcy trustees and receivers can direct the Office of Outer Space Claims to sell, you know, that they can approve a sale to somebody and then direct the Office of Outer Space Claims to issue a new deed to the buyer.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this local area, one of the key things that makes for abandoned property is somebody dies. So it's kind of like, well, who really owns it if there's nobody alive to own it? And that's when it commonly falls back to the county.
Well, this law says, and I've already written this, it says that that property can pass by inheritance or intestate succession. And so if the party dies with the will, then they can bequeath that property to whoever they like in their will. Or if they die without a will, this is if it's an individual property owner, then the state where that person resides, the U.S., United States state where they reside, the intestate law, laws of succession for that state would then govern who would receive title to the property.
Yeah, if it's California, I guarantee you California will own the property.
I was just about to say that, gee, that means that nobody on Mars could be a Martian. They have to be a California citizen or, you know, citizen of one of the states. And that really doesn't make sense, particularly after three generations of people born on Mars.
I bet California is not going to be the only one that has something like that going on, too.
We've already seen some competition between states regarding passing state laws that provide protections for certain activities like tourist space flight.
Right. Yeah, because a lot of people will see this as valuable, and they, if there's a way to get their hands on it and maybe tax it or do something with it, they're not going to miss a golden opportunity.
There's one other issue, and that is, how do you set about, well, let me back up here. In Oklahoma, they had the Cherokee Strip Outlet, which basically was the northwest corner of Oklahoma, and they basically sectioned up the land into quarter sections, and there was a big, you know, land rush to go and stake your claim and do the five-year thing. Oh, I forget what it was called, the Land Act or something like that, Abraham Lincoln. You know, Homestead Act,
right,
to just homestead the land. And, gee, who's going to decide what the parcels of land is? Because, let's face it, if Boeing gets to the moon, they ain't going to be happy with 160 acres.
Well, they'll have to be, because the law provides that it's unsafe, generally. If you have multiple facilities in a contiguous area, it's generally unsafe to move those facilities further apart rather than closer together. And it's much safer to have facilities closer together, because then if one of the facilities loses pressure, they can quickly be rescued by somebody else on the property. And so, in fact, I highlighted a bunch of stuff in here. It might be better if I just read it. But it says in here, there's a presumption that it's safer to have facilities closer together rather than far apart. And it says that people who apply for property rights shall lay out the property so that it uses the least amount of property to safely operate the facility. But it does say that any commercial facility that is open to the public for retail sales will be entitled to a larger safety zone, because there will be people coming and going and a lot more activity, so a larger safety zone would be justified.
Retail
so
sales?
It covers retail and, you know, commercial activities, but it also you know, provides that private property owners, including a corporation, will claim the least amount of property possible as long as they can still perform what they do, the activities that they want to do.
That sounds like something a corporate lawyer would have a field day playing with. You know. Anyway, that's all for me at the moment.
Thank you, Marshall.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. Listener, Marshall has cleared up our toll-free line. If you would like to use it, and hopefully you will, 1-866-687-7223. Do you have a timeline for when this will come to a head in Congress?
Well, you know, that was one thing I meant to check before this show, but I want to look at the congressional calendar and see whether they'll have time in this session or whether it'll have to be next year. I've worked with this for so long, I'm going to put together a frequently asked questions to go with the bill when I distribute it, in order to try to speed that process along.
You have another caller. Unfortunately, I don't know who it is. So, hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show with Wayne White. Who are you? Where are you?
This is Doug from Redlands.
Okay. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It seems as though, although the countries are not granting, well, how can I say this? They're, these pieces of land are not becoming sovereign property of the country, but the country is basically regulating what individual companies or individual people say, hey, I'm an American and I'm using this area, and so you sort of register it with your country, and your country and the other participating countries who recognize each other's claims, you basically have land ownership by usage. Is that right?
Yes, that's true.
I mean, this is full ownership because you can pass it on to your children, right?
No, it's not full ownership because you can't sell property. You can't sell mineral rights underneath your facility. There are a number of reasons why it's not the same as property. So another thing that I should say is that, yes, the safety zone is an addition to the legal scheme. Other than that, the U.S. jurisdiction is the same as it would be without a property law. So it's not enabling countries to have any more jurisdiction than they already have. But what it does do is it allows nations to govern their, as you have said, to govern their entities' activities while they're in that area. And the governments are required to do that by the Outer Space Treaty in any event. So this is really an enabling these are enabling statutes that will provide a legal framework for the activities that we already expect to occur.
So as a practical matter, it seems to me probably what, in the relative near term, what's most important and relevant is actually the ability to exclude other entities from extracting ice from the regolith on the moon within your immediate area. Would you be inclined to agree that that's the highest value property rights?
Well, at this point, yes. I think ice is probably the most valuable thing out there right now because it can be used for rocket fuel and for growing plants and for people to drink. Water is very, very important. I've struggled with is what I mentioned earlier, which is the tension between the free access provision and the right to be free from interference. And so if a company or an international group or, you know, if any group or private entity up there establishes a property right and that gives, you know, and they, well, actually they probably wouldn't apply for a property right. They'd apply for a mining claim. What I think might be the only way really to resolve that tension would be to say that the entity that has claimed a mining, has perfected a mining claim, has the right to exclude others, but because the others are not able to access that resource, the way that the mining company can allow free access would be to sell to whoever asks, you know, whoever wants to buy ice from that company can buy ice from that company, and the company will not charge a higher price to anyone. You know, there should just be a market price that would be good for everybody. And so it's a compromise that I think it's about the only way to keep companies from completely monopolizing resources. The only thing that would modify that for the United States is that the Space Pioneer Act will provide for export compliance. You know, export compliance will apply. If a company wants to sell their facility, then they're going to have to, you know, and it's to somebody from another country, they will have to get a license, or there must be an export compliance exemption for them to sell that. So the same in the same respects, if our country decided, for example, we have export blanket export restrictions on Iran and North Korea, and you pretty much can't get a license to export anything to those countries. Well, if North Korea wanted to buy ice from you, then the export compliance office at the State Department might well say, do we really want to do that? And they might not approve the export license. So there might be some limited exceptions to that, but there are only, I don't know, 5 or 6 countries that we have blanket export restrictions. So
Wayne, what's the radius of on the lunar surface of this safety zone?
Well, it's going to vary depending on what the facilities are, what type of activities are going on in that area. And I should say, in areas of mining activity, whenever the activity ceases, anybody whose property or mining claim, anytime there's a change to the number of facilities that are in the area, if you add another facility, the property owner or the mining perfected mining claim owner has to report that to the Department of the Interior, which is where the Office of Outer Space Claims would be. They will have to report that and then have the boundaries of their property or the safety zone adjusted to accommodate for that.
I think the Office of the Interior needs to develop a sub-office of the exterior in this case.
Well, I was just going to address that, and I'm glad it came up. One of the aims of my law is that we would be able to use as many terrestrial legal examples as we can, so that we don't develop an entirely new body of the law. So that's not necessary to create an entirely new body of the law. So, for example, on Earth, a frequent property litigation matter might be a boundary dispute. On the moon, it doesn't really matter that there's no atmosphere if you have a boundary dispute. And so my law says that the U.S. courts can look to U.S. real property law or state law, as the case may be. Actually, no, it would be federal law with respect to the property rights or mining claim. They can look to previous legal precedents, regardless of whether it's in outer space or on Earth. And so the Department of the Interior is the organization that handles mining claims, and in the past they handled the homesteading claims. There aren't any homesteading claims on the books right – or laws on the books right now. But they have this body of previous legal precedents that they have developed in their administrative court. And so that's why I chose to have the Office of Outer Space Claims in the Department of the Interior, because they already deal with those kind of issues, and they have in the past.
Right. Wayne, there's a couple more things I wanted to mention, if I could. One of them is the safety zone related to a landing blast?
A landing block?
Blast. In other words, the exhaust blast of a lander can damage equipment, a fair distance from the landing zone.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I actually have addressed that in the law. And that
because
that's
could,
one of the
well
ones
be,
that I think it would be helpful if I read it. Let's see. Okay, there's that first
Wayne.
One. Okay, so here's what it says. In the low-gravity environments of the Moon and Mars, regolith ejected by rocket exhaust can travel long distances and may pose a danger or be a nuisance to others. Whenever possible, operators of launch and landing facilities on celestial bodies shall locate their spaceports in an area that is surrounded by higher terrain, such as a crater, in order to prevent long-range ejected damage. The Office of Outer Space Claims may approve an unshielded launch landing site if the developer of the spaceport justifies an exception and there are no other facilities located within the range of ejecta from the spaceport.
I like that. Yeah. I got to say, from a technical standpoint, I think it's possible to create landing pads on a completely flat surface, and you just create your own crater. You just put a telerobotically, you put up a berm, mm-hmm. and then there's a way of laying down pads or creating pads
right.
that would protect against blast immediately under the precision landers, and then slightly away and over the berm, slightly over the berm. If you just cover it so the exhaust gas goes over the tarp and doesn't interact with the regolith, it's possible uh-huh. to completely get rid of the sandblasting problems by proper design of landing pads.
Yes, another thing that where it's two completely different things are going to assist each other is that initial mining activity, you know, a substantial part of that might be just pieces of heavy equipment that vacuum up the regolith and process it. And that would leave you with bare ground, which would be much, much better in terms of reducing ejecta.
The depth of regolith might be far higher than what would make that practical. I mean, we're talking maybe even tens of meters.
Really? I didn't.
Yeah.
So the sites where we landed during the Apollo program were sites that had exceptionally shallow regolith?
I don't recall them hitting bedrock with their exhaust. I mean, there was little
so it was just
erosion
packed.
Of the regolith.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Finally, in the longer term, you know, when you have every trip of the Starship, and the Starship could maybe get to cycling, doing round trips every 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
if you're having 100 people being delivered and you
mm-hmm.
have a fleet of Starships, you
mm-hmm.
can conceivably have a fairly rapid population, and a lot of these people will be speaking languages that the other people on the moon do not know. And so people might find themselves separating into sort of colonies based on language,
mm-hmm.
sort of logically. And in that situation, if people are so intermingled together because of how property rights have been handled, then when it comes to the population of one language group reaching a level where they feel like, hey, we want to have our own political independence, you may have really interlocking territory. You know, people who speak Portuguese, for example, might be rather interlocked, and it might be difficult to draw lines. And I could imagine at some point people might want to say that they want to create their own political entities. Any
mm-hmm.
thoughts about how decisions at this point in time could have unintended consequences in the long run? And I'll take my my answer off air.
Thank you, Doug. Go ahead.
I think the International Space Station is a good example. The United States astronauts get training in the Russian language. You know, the astronauts that are going to be doing missions to the space station get Russian language instruction so that they can communicate to the extent that a conversation couldn't be handled in English. Generally, English is known by, you know, an awful lot of people. But I think that when private parties are planning a facility, that would be one of the things that they want to address. Maybe they want to make English the official language of that settlement. I think it would be dealt with on a case-by-case basis, but I don't see that being a major unintended consequence.
It is the language of aviation, don't forget. English.
Mm-hmm.
So, having listened to Doug's lengthy call and some of the what-ifs and will this and all that be projected there, is there going to be any, I know this is a crazy question for you, but I'm halfway serious and halfway joking with you and spoofing.
Mm-hmm.
Is there going to be any screening test for fringe, lunacy, plausibility, fantasy, whack job regarding what they want to do in space?
Well, I wish you hadn't used so many derogatory.
Well, they're not derogatory.
Words,
they're kind of fun and entertaining and amusing in many ways. But seriously,
okay.
there there's some stuff being talked about that, you know, if it's around in 100 years, we'd be lucky, let alone, you know, 5 years or 10 years. And, you know, does some fringe crazy idea that somebody has because they have money and can go to the moon, I've heard them all. Well, I haven't heard them all. I get three or four submitted every week, and I think I've heard them all. So is there any screening or testing to be done for plausibility and reality?
Well, your question brought something to mind that's not directly on point, but I want to talk about it briefly. One thing that the law will do is it says that any deeds that people might have purchased that are not based upon international and national laws regarding property, those novelty deeds will be null and void. And so these companies that have sold novelty deeds to property on the moon and Mars and stuff, those will be officially not recognized by the United States government by statute as part of this law.
But what about ideas that you want to do in space? Is there any screening to make sure they're plausible?
That's what I was going to continue with. I think what your question is more directed at is what they do when they get there.
Correct.
And, you know, how crazy is it?
Yeah, correct.
Now, Bigelow Aerospace had applied for a mission license. They applied to the commercial space office at the Department of Transportation. And although the statutes and regulations governing that office didn't specifically have any provisions about a mission approval, I think that's something that's going to have to happen. And for every mission, I think there needs to be a mission review and mission approval process. I think it may be somewhat similar in some respects to the process for approving space launch sites in the United States, here on Earth, in that there will be some environmental provisions that, you know, the government, the U.S. government will need to review their mission plans to make sure that, you know, if they have a radiothermal generator to generate power, needs to be a safe distance away from any habitation facilities, and preferably it would be buried to, you know, in case there was a problem with it, it would provide some radiation protection. But also, the law is going to say that they can't put harmful chemicals into the ground and that sort of thing. And so the environmental aspects will be one aspect by which I think the government should review these emissions to make sure that they aren't doing anything unsafe.
Because a lot of people have access to money and, you know, they could want to do something that is totally fantasy driven. Aside from an amusement park, which, mm-hmm. you know, if you could make that work, I'd be all for it. And why would you even want, you know, to, you know, cheapens the wrong word, but why would you want to lessen the value of all of this by considering whack job projects that just because people have money or can raise money or can do mm-hmm. $1 million quick Kickstarter or something, They get to go up there and, you know, who knows what, put a sauna on the moon. I don't know. But there ought to be some kind of oversight for reality and plausibility. I guess that's what I'm suggesting.
I don't think I would agree with that. I think that might be controversial. When the government starts telling people what they can do and what they can't do when it doesn't hurt anyone else, particularly when they're telling businesses what to do when it doesn't hurt anyone else, I think there's a danger there, a loss of freedom.
But to do things can also be damaging to the whole movement, even if they never, you know, get started. Mm-hmm. It just gets the brand name and branded as kook.
Well, I think a similar discussion has occurred around the idea of putting billboards in orbit above the Earth.
Right.
Which, you know, and people have talked about putting a Coke sign up there. I don't know if the Coca-Cola company was involved in that. But those kind of marketing ideas, which I think, you know, I would sure not want to see that kind of stuff looking up into the night sky. So I think there are things like that that people are going to want to regulate. And I think, you know, I'm not going to go into that much detail in this law. I think that, say, for example, I got to the point where a company says, we're launching our billboard, you know, in a year and a half. This is our plan. Well, you know, maybe somebody wants to go to their congressperson and say, we need to pass a law. We can't be doing this. And I think that's pretty analogous, because I would think that that cheapens a very noble enterprise.
Or they want to take 160 acres on the moon and put huge signage that would show up on Earth. I mean, that's mm-hmm. pretty far-fetched. But let's just say they could put 25 really huge, humongous mm-hmm. lit signs on 160 acres on the moon that you could see without a telescope from Earth. Who the hell wants that? But they have the
right.
money. They have the money to do that. Would that be something that they could go do, or would that be crazy?
I think that that would be something they could go do unless we pass a law that says you can't do that. And so I think that, you know, that's something that'll just have to be addressed as it comes
but,
up.
But it's not part of your law. That's my point. You don't have any provisions
right.
for
oversight. It's not part of my law. What we could do, what I could do, is put something in the property rights section that says if the Office of Outer Space, well, it would probably be the Department of Transportation, the Department of Transportation Office of Commercial Space Transportation, questions whether an act, you know, if that's the office that's reviewing missions, reviewing and approving missions, if they see an activity that a company is proposing that they don't think is such a good idea, that they should be free to go to Congress and say, we don't think that the majority of American people would like this. So if you want to pass a law, now's the time.
Wayne, we have moved way beyond the break point, and we've spent all of this time on part one, which is property rights, but you have three other parts. I'm going to skip the break, but I do need to read the sponsor messages, but we're not going to take a break. And I suggest to the listeners that we move on beyond property rights, even though it's probably not a finished discussion, and go on to other components of what your law is all about. Listeners, for sponsors for the second segment, the Space Development Network sponsors us. Would you like to see space settlement occur within your lifetime? The Space Development Network is an online organization allowing you to join together with others to advance the plan of space development. They're looking for people with a wide variety of interest and skills. Remember, the network is free to join and learn more. Check it out at developspace.info. And then Celestis is a sponsor, so please remember that they are the only iconic pioneer and proven Memorial Spaceflight Services company. They've been to the moon, orbital, and suborbital. And I've used their services three times. You've heard me talk about it. You can send a small amount of your loved one's cremated ashes to space, and if they don't do cremation, you can do DNA. You can also use your DNA and join with your loved ones for symbolically making the journey together. And as I said, there's lots of opportunities for suborbital, orbital. They are going to be returning to the moon. I'm on their next moon mission. Not me personally, but my mom and two dogs. And one of these days, they'll be on free stations in space and in Mars. So they're an incredible company of caring, wonderful people to work with. It's an amazing experience. I've attended the launches, and I've talked to people who were not space cadets, but their loved one had an interest in space, so they wanted to do this, and it was really amazing. Check them out at Celestis, CelestisTIS.com. They do advanced planning if that interests you or your loved one. So, again, Celestis.com. The National Space Society is a sponsor. Remember, that's how I believe I initially met Wayne. And there you can still get to them at nss.org. That's easier for me to recite, even though their website's actually changed a little bit. They have great ISDC event. It's going to be in Frisco, Texas at the end of May 2020. That's part of Dallas. And they do space settlement conferences in Santa Monica, and they issue white papers, and they address many, many things that interest Space Show listeners. So do check them out for sure. And the Integrated Space Plan is a sponsor. This is the highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming spacefaring. They have a new one due to a successful Kickstarter program for 2019. Also, the document poster showing the space race with the old Soviet Union and the U.S. back in the day. You can get these posters yourself. Go to thespaceplan.com, and they have different types and varieties to offer, which are explained there. So again, thespaceplan.com. Wayne, you know, if it's okay with you, I really think we should move away from property rights to other parts
Oh, yeah.
of your act.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and in fact, we've actually covered a lot of the mining stuff as well. The mining stuff is very analogous to the property rights. They have their due diligence requirements. And with respect to the mining, they would do a preliminary claim. It would not cost them anything to file a preliminary claim. Then they would have to be operational for a period of 2 years, and then they could apply to perfect their mining claim. I'll be looking at U.S. mining law for a few specific provisions that are universal, such as you can't, it's illegal to undermine another person's property rights. So I guess, and really the only other thing that I should mention is that geologists do define ice as a mineral, and I would be specifically saying that in the mining law, that ice is a mineral and it is subject to the terms of this mining law. So there's that. So then I think we can move along to the salvage section, which is quite a bit different from the other two sections, although it won't be nearly as long. So there are two forms of salvage. There's contract salvage, and then there's emergency salvage. If a ship and its cargo and passengers are in immediate danger of losing lives or losing cargo, in maritime law, a salvor, which is the salvage company, can go ahead and salvage a ship or, you know, or cargo that's floating in the sea because the ship sank, or people that are in lifeboats because the ship sank. A salvage company can do emergency salvage without a contract, and then after, if only if they successfully provide a benefit as a result of their efforts, then they can be compensated for the cost of their salvage efforts. I would guess in the field of maritime salvage here on Earth, I would suspect that probably 90% of it, if not more, is by contract. And so this salvage law will have some general provisions, and it will say that the salvage laws, you know, are to be consistent with the 1989 International Convention on Salvage, which the U.S. is a party to. And that agreement, which I just skimmed through this morning in preparation for the show, has many, many good provisions. It can only help. It only helps. And so this law will be, it will have some stuff that's specific to the United States, but it will be consistent with the way we already handle our maritime salvage. The real legwork will probably be done by the space insurance companies, because, you know, this law, I'll probably put something in there that says we encourage companies that underwrite space insurance to develop a form salvage contract for salvage activities in outer space. The reason I think the salvage law is so important is that it provides a legal framework for companies to come in and salvage satellites. I haven't thought about it at length, but I think that it will probably be best to include refueling operations for satellites under the umbrella of salvage, just because there are so many provisions that apply to that, even though it's just a standard contract for services. I think it would be best to do that within the context of the salvage law. So the law will cover the contract and emergency salvage, but it will not include a standard form contract for outer space salvage. Another helpful part of this law will be to say, just like in the law of maritime salvage, flotsam and jetsam is unidentifiable debris. It's debris who you can't determine who the owner is. And so in maritime salvage, any salvage company is free to scoop up flotsam and jetsam if it has any value, and it's like the finder's keeper's law. You can take possession of that flotsam and jetsam, and you can own it. The law will also say that if there's any possible way of determining where the debris came from, then you will have to talk to the owner. And normally you would do a contract to salvage that. Bankruptcy trustees and receivers will be able to enter into a salvage contract if it's necessary to maximize the economic value of the assets that are left in a bankruptcy. So I'm hoping that this will provide a big incentive for companies to develop technologies to alleviate the debris problem. And we're already working on that. Lots of companies are working on that. But this will provide additional incentive because it'll answer a lot of legal questions that might come up. So there are less, that companies can focus on the real technical issues of whatever needs to be done pursuant to the contract, rather than worrying about a lot of unanswered legal questions.
Is this part of the Pioneering Act, and it's submitted at the same time the property rights part is?
Yes, the Space Pioneer Act will be property rights, mining claims, and salvage law, plus some general jurisdictional stuff.
Okay. Go ahead.
The general jurisdictional stuff is about statutes of limitations, what courts have jurisdiction, and that sort of thing. So those provisions would apply to all three areas.
Okay. Then what? Or is that it? Are those the complete parts of the space pioneering?
Yeah.
That's what I mean.
That's what it covers.
So you have property rights, and you have mining, and then you have salvage.
Right.
So there's only three parts to it.
Yes.
Well,
there's four. I'm at the beginning. There are a bunch of miscellaneous provisions. One thing that I didn't think that's very important is Congressman Rohrabacher had come up with, he and his staffers had come up with a draft law for zero G, zero tax.
Right.
And that's a great idea. That particular piece of draft legislation is pretty complicated. I'm expecting to include a very simple general provision that says any income that's earned in outer space, and the product, and if the product and services are used in space, then there won't be any tax on that income. And so looking at mining, one of the concerns, and I have some other thoughts too, one of the concerns is that people will go out and mine things that are needed on Earth, and they will they'll sell the minerals on Earth rather than in outer space, which would affect the mining markets here on Earth. And so for things like rare earth minerals, the United States does not have a lot of rare earth minerals, and China has the majority of them. There's a real good business case for mining rare earth metals where if you can find them in outer space. I'm sure you can find them. The asteroids contain, you know, the asteroid belt probably has everything that our planet has. So there will be an incentive for people to sell products like ice, which you would break down into hydrogen and oxygen if it wasn't for consumption. If you're mining ice and you're selling it as hydrogen and oxygen rocket fuel for use in outer space, then you shouldn't have to get taxed on that, because we want to incentivize the growth of an outer space economy. And taxing it is not a good way to do that. But we don't want, at the same time, we don't want to disrupt Earth natural natural resources markets, except for things, the rare earth minerals are a small part of global mining here on Earth. That wouldn't really provide that big of an impact to countries other than the United States. It would benefit the United States mainly, bringing those rare earth minerals back. And it would help any of our allies that have trouble getting that if there's enough to sell to other, to our allies. So, I think there's a good case for providing incentive for provision of products and services for use in outer space. And I certainly think it's okay to bring minerals back from outer space if there's a market for it on Earth. So, you know, hopefully just saying that there's no tax on products and services that are used in outer space, I think that's a good way to go. That's not very complicated. So I'm intending to put that in there.
Do you have any congressional feedback on some of these ideas yet, or is it too new?
Well, I guess there's one thing that a lot of my friends know this. It's not public knowledge, but in December of 2001, the Bush administration announced that they were going to enact property rights based on my work. And so, and I've talked to, I've been on the UN delegation of the Committee on the Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space Legal Subcommittee, and the head of the delegation before I went on that trip to Vienna, Austria. That's where the Office of Outer Space Affairs is, and they have a UN center there. The State Department told me that they had read all of my articles and that my approach was valid in all cases. So I think there's been quite a bit of vetting at the bureaucratic level of my work, and I think that would come out in Congress. I should add the Asteroids Act and the Space Competitiveness Act that provided that U.S. entities can appropriate and own extracted resources. I had also written about that prior to the enactment of that. And so I think there's some understanding in the space committees, the House Space Committee and the Senate Space Committee. There, I think they understand they understand international law, at least to the extent to understand that the majority view in space law circles is that you can own extracted resources. And so the United States said, that's our view as well, so we're going to enact a law to make that, you know, effective. And we've done that. And so I think there's, you know, at least in the committees, there's a good understanding of what's legal and what isn't. I would expect there to be hearings on it, but I don't think it's all that controversial.
You have an email from Marshall, and he said, is a political banner put in orbit by North Korea saying Trump sucks space junk or property. Elizabeth Warren wants to put up a political banner. Is it junk or property? How about Iran? 8D. I don't know what the hell that means. 8-D. Marshall, so you're not too political on the space show. Marshall, you know you're not supposed to go down that road. So I guess what he's saying is there a supervisory service or something or censorship of what you might say on a banner that you put up? And this goes back to what you were saying before I said we were going to skip the break.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's really nothing in the Outer Space Treaty or any of the other multilateral space agreements. There's really nothing in there that would govern that, unless you consider it a form of pollution. So I think that will have to be dealt with when it comes up. But in the absence of a provision in any of the international treaties that we're a party to, there's no way we can stop Iran or North Korea from putting a big billboard up in orbit or on the moon. But I think that would cause an uproar, and I think that the UN would do its best to address that as quickly as possible.
What about the space show logo on the moon? Could we get away with that?
Visible from Earth?
Yes. With the website domain listed.
I think it's like you said earlier, I think the majority of people would probably find that objectionable, and our lawmakers would hear about it.
Well, all we need is the money to pull that one up, listeners. So please dig deep into your PayPal accounts. We're going to put our – Wayne says we can put our logo on the moon even if people object to it. So think of all the free publicity I'd get in the meantime waiting for them to object to it and tell me to somehow mm-hmm. take it down. And I don't know how you'd take it down if you got it up there. That might be interesting. How do you remove something that's objectionable?
Yeah. You know, what we might be able to do is to say that, this won't be in my law, but what the U.S. might be able to do is to say that the Office of Commercial Space Transportation, in performing mission reviews, shall have the right to come back and say, this mission requires congressional approval.
Like payload review kind of thing.
Yes, the payload review. Yes, that's what Bigelow called its application, a payload review.
Payload review for a space show logo on the moon. What has we come
yeah.
to? Okay.
But I think, as I said earlier, I think we are going to have mission reviews before anybody launches anything. You know, that we're going to have to have laws and regulations that provide a process for mission review. And one aspect of that law might be to say that the Office of Commercial Space Transportation may respond that the mission will require congressional approval. And so in that way, there would be a broader public review of something that might be controversial.
Well, you can kiss the project away if you have to go to get congressional. Can you imagine the complex process and to get congressional review of something? Listeners, we're moving close to the end of our program today with Wayne. If you would like to call us, you can still do so. And it is toll-free 1-866-687-7223, but you do need to hurry. And you can still send in an email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And we'd still like to hear from you, so I'm going to ask Wayne to sort of take us through a conclusion, and that ought to give you time to respond if you want to get a call in or an email in. So, Wayne, how would you draw this to a conclusion, summarize it? What would you say the important takeaways are for our listeners today?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway is that a lot of people are working on getting laws in place that will provide a legal framework to enable commercial development of outer space and settlement of outer space. And this is a big part of it, but it's, you know, there are other things to do. There, you know, there's a lot of other efforts going on. So I think if this law gets enacted, I think it's we're going to have space race part two. And I think that's a good thing, you know. I don't know. I just see us spending billions and billions on wars. I would sure like to see us spend money both privately and publicly on things that build economic capability and that improve people's lives.
Hey, we're going to
make
fight.
Our economy better.
We're going to fight to have that logo on the moon, Wayne.
Okay.
We're going to go into space combat with the new space with the new space force. I have another email that came in. Karen is up in Seattle, and Karen says this all does sound pretty interesting. But I'm just curious as to how you end up playing a role in this. My understanding is that bills that get promoted in Congress, even bills that fail, are promoted by someone or sponsored by someone in Congress, but you're not in Congress. So would you have to give up your authorship so that somebody could say, I sponsored this, or two or three people would say they sponsored it? Since I don't think you're allowed to sponsor legislation, is that the way it works, or do I have an incorrect understanding?
No. As I had said earlier, I've spoken with one congressman and other congresspeople, staffers. So when I finish this, my first task will be to reach out to congressional staffs, in order to seek sponsors. But a local congressman here who I've known many years from when I practiced back in the 90s, he is very interested, and he has asked me to send it as soon as I have it done. Congressman Rohrabacher, unfortunately, didn't get reelected, and he would have been another person that I, in fact, I've been talking to his former staffer. I talked to him for a couple of decades about all this stuff, so, you know, that's another person that would probably have co-sponsored. But if you look to the Asteroids Act, which dealt with extraction and ownership of extraterrestrial resources, it had bipartisan support, including a congressman from the state of Washington. And so I think that the states who would most benefit from this law, their representatives would be the people that I would expect to co-sponsor it. So all, you know, Texas, California, Colorado, Washington State, states that have a lot of their economic income comes from the space program, those are the states where I would expect their representatives to want to co-sponsor.
When's a good time to check back with you for progress?
I'd say late October.
Boy, that's pretty close. We're practically in October now.
Well, you know, I'm working full-time as an attorney, and I have to say I've gotten to the age where working nights and weekends is more of a struggle. And pretty much my whole adult life, I have worked nights and weekends in order to do my space law. And then more recently, my patents. So I told my employer, I said, I don't think I'm going to get this done in a reasonable period of time if I don't take some time off. And so they are amenable to me taking a month off to finish this. And I think I can finish it working full time for a month. I think I can finish it.
You're going to stay in Denver as you're doing this, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I wish you luck, and we've been following you on this. Well, the first time I met you and the first time you were on the space program, you introduced space property rights to us. Listeners, if you go back to his very, very first space show program, probably around 2003 or 2004, he was talking about his concept of legal property rights. He was the first guest on the space show to really delve into the topic. So,
you know, when I started writing about property rights in outer space?
Well, before I met you, I'm sure, because you were pretty well developed.
1981 in law school, I started working on this.
In law school?
Yes. It was my law review article, and it became so long. The original version of Real Property Rights in Outer Space is the size of a small book. So,
what got you going back in 1981 as a law student?
Well, I've been very passionate and excited about space since I was a kid, and so when I was younger, I joined the L5 Society not too long after it was formed, and I started going to some of their earlier conferences, which really got me enthusiastic. And so then I had actually chosen to go to UC Davis because they have a very large collection of space law materials in their library. And so I wrote my personal statement when I applied for law school. I wrote about space law. I said, I want to do space law, and I want to come to your school because you have all these materials and you obviously have interest in this subject. And so this is a lifelong project for me.
You were a guest on the space show January 7th of 2002. That's 6 months after we started the program, right after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have a summary because I wasn't writing summaries at the time. Also, I noticed it's a 77 megabyte show, so that file did not convert when we changed them. But this, I remember it was about property rights because almost all of your appearances on the program have been about property rights. But yeah, so listeners, Wayne goes back to the very essence and beginning of the space show. So, and we're glad we're continuing the saga, but damn it, it's time results get going.
Mm-hmm.
What can I say? We're almost 20 years, we're coming up on 19 years and then 20 years. So, plus whatever time you started on from your law review article.
Mm-hmm.
So this, and
yeah.
There have probably been people who have been thinking about it even before you did your law review article.
There were people that thought of it before me. I am the first person in the legal field. My articles, Real Property Rights in Outer Space, Mining Law for Outer Space, and Salvage Law for Outer Space, those are all the first articles written on those topics in the U.S.
Now, actually, since you're one of the guests I know personally, I would have depicted you as being much, much younger than all of this chronology indicates. So whatever you're doing works well for you. So,
well, I'm gonna reach full retirement age in October while I'm finishing this.
So you're not that much younger than I am. So because I'm 73, and so you're mid 60s, I guess, right?
I'll be 66 next month.
Yeah, so that's 7 years different. Well, I'm glad you're part of the space show guest family, and it's been a long journey, so hurry up and get some results.
Well, you know, that's a nice lead-in. I just want to say something that you probably don't hear often enough. Thank you very much for all your years of putting on the space show. It's tremendous service for the aerospace community, and thank you.
Well, it's that way because of guests like you and 4,000 others, plus callers, Marshall included, from Renfro, Oklahoma. We'll look forward to your follow-up, and we'll see how you're doing toward the end of the month, end of October month, and maybe the end of this year. And I hope the coming elections don't thwart your efforts to get bipartisan congressional support for legislation. I hope you don't get told we got to wait until after the election. And
Me too.
But we all know that's a risk in this day and age.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to also thank your callers because I have to say every time someone makes a good comment, you know, I jotted down notes, and some of these things are going to result in tweaks to what I'm writing. So I very much appreciate people's comments and questions.
Stay in touch, Wayne, and the journey continues, and we'll look forward to the next chapter, okay?
Okay. Thanks, David.
Thank you. And listeners, thank you for this. Remember, Dave Criswell was a great member of our family, too, and we lost him on September 10th. So this week is all in Dave's memory, including the show today with Wayne. And we will be back on Tuesday. Lava tubes and Martian lava tubes, lunar and Martian lava tubes, with Anahita. And she presented this very effectively at the Lunar Track on ISDC. That's where I met her. Very impressive, and I think you're going to be in for an outstanding discussion with Dr. Mogliari, if I got her name right, but I do have her first name right, Anahita. So that'll be on Tuesday night. Dallas Benhoff is on Friday, Cislunar Development, and fresh from the SSI Space Settlement Conference up in Seattle. And then, as I said, open lines on Sunday. We say goodbye to Wayne, and we thank him very much for not just today, but for all these years of his work on property rights and being a great guest on the Space Show. And all of you who emailed us and called in, and all of you who will post blog comments once this program is archived. Have a great rest of the weekend. Goodbye from the Space Show, and keep it safe, and please do keep looking up.